Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
Senate Republicans meet for their regular weekly lunch today, but today they'll be hosting the President of the United States. Oh, to be a fly on that wall. This morning, Tennessee Senator Bob Corker, a frequent presidential sparring partner, said Trump should step aside and let Congress handle a new tax plan, to which the president tweeted, "Corker couldn't be elected dog catcher." Then Corker came back with this on CNN.
Unfortunately, I think world leaders are very aware that much of what he says is untrue. Certainly people here are, because these things are provably untrue. I mean, they're factually incorrect, and people know the difference. So I don't know why he lowers himself to such a low, low standard and debases our country in the way that he does, but he does.
President Trump fired back on Twitter that Corker was fighting tax cuts. Corker came back on CNN to say Trump hasn't evolved. Lost in all of this, that tax plan. NPR lead politics editor Domenico Montanaro is here. Domenico, we hear Republican analysts saying Corker's retiring. He's just saying what he feels like. He doesn't matter because he's a deficit hawk. He wouldn't go for this deficit-producing tax cuts the president wants anyway. Is that true? Corker doesn't matter?
It's not that Corker doesn't matter, but it's true that Corker has for a long time been very anti anything that adds to the debt and deficit. And this plan would do that, as far as most analysts have predicted, and, you know, would bring in $1.5 trillion less in revenue over the next 10 years. And all of that is a big problem for someone like Corker, who has said for a long time he wouldn't vote for something that adds to the debt and deficit. Now, that means that the margin is even narrower for this president to get a tax overhaul through, because they can only lose two votes, Republicans. So if Corker's out, they can't afford to lose another.
Well, what about John McCain, who's fighting cancer? And the president's been battling him over the weekend. McCain said that during Vietnam, military service fell disproportionately to poor Americans. Wealthy people got out of the draft for dubious reasons like bone spurs. Now, Donald Trump got out of the draft with bone spurs. McCain said he's not talking about Trump. He's been using that example for decades, but they've been going back and forth as well. Where is McCain on tax overhaul?
Well, first, McCain was happy to let it sit out there that it could be about President Trump. When he was on The View, where a show his daughter helps host, he said, he knew multiple times that Donald Trump had not deferred from the draft. So he's not unaware of what his comments could be interpreted as, but it is an example he's used for a long time. When it comes to tax reform or tax overhaul, you know, McCain is somebody who would likely vote for something like this. He's been somebody who is a conservative all of his life, and a fiscal conservative as well, aside from when it comes to the military, and would prefer to ramp up spending when it comes to military operations. But he's a maverick, right? And he's somebody who also, like Corker, you know, doesn't really feel like he needs to care very much whether or not Donald Trump thinks he's loyal to him.
Yeah. Well, the president also tweeted out that there will be no change to your 401ks. This came after there was a trial balloon, is how it was called, a proposal to limit how much tax-deferred money people can put in those retirement accounts. Hawks want some of that money taxed to offset the huge cost of the president's tax cuts. But if the money for these cuts doesn't come from changes to 401k accounts, it has to come from somewhere else. Do we know where it might come from?
Well, and another area where it's very popular, would be a revenue generator, is when it comes to that mortgage deduction. And the mortgage deduction is very popular. So to get rid of that, or would even further reduce the amount of money that they could possibly bring in. And this is where it becomes politically very tricky, because the more attention is paid to what's actually in whatever the overhaul details are, the more people become aware of it, the more they lobby Congress, and the more a lot of things are stripped out of it. It's why nothing's gotten done in 30 years on this.
Domenico, we have less than a minute. What's going to happen at this lunch?
Well, you know, I doubt there'll be fisticuffs or something like that. But, you know, Corker has said that he's happy to go. It's his lunch. Of course, he's going to go. President Trump will be there. And it might not be outside the realm of possibility that he takes a pot shot at Corker. You know, this is somebody who has done that in the past. You know, if you listen to NPR's Embedded podcast, they went out to Rancho Palos Verdes, California, where Trump was building a golf course, and used an epithet about somebody there who he felt was an opponent. So we'll see if there's any kind of fireworks.
Food fight. NPR lead politics editor Domenico Montanaro, thank you.
All right, you're welcome.
The vast majority of Puerto Ricans are still without power more than a month after Hurricane Maria devastated the island's electrical grid. Now, rebuilding it is a huge job, but the biggest contract awarded so far has gone to a tiny for-profit Montana company that had only two permanent employees when the storm hit. Whitefish Energy said last week that it has signed a $300 million contract with the Puerto Rico Electric Power Authority, or PREPA, but some are questioning the company's qualifications and how it got the contract. So let's bring in Jack Gillum. He's an investigative reporter with The Washington Post. And Jack, so this is a small company. It's based in Whitefish, Montana, which also happens to be the hometown of Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke. So is there a connection here?
So Interior Secretary Zinke is from this small town in Whitefish, and this is a connection that the CEO of Whitefish Energy, Andy Tekmansky, had told us that indeed existed, that they had known each other. He said maybe not particularly well, but they had been in contact with each other in the past, and particularly this most recent case. He reached out to Zinke's office. His secretary said that, you know, this wasn't anything out of the ordinary, that this was a normal, you know, way that his office would approach the business community, but it does sort of raise an interesting question of the ties between the Interior Secretary and this small company, although neither say that they were directly responsible for this deal going through.
Right, but there are interesting connections because you report that Ryan Zinke's son for at least a little while, had a summer job there with Whitefish Energy. But I guess what's really curious is how did this tiny company get this enormous contract? How did that even happen? There was no bidding?
No, and that is something that the CEO had confirmed to us. And what's interesting about this whole process is that PREPA, which is the Puerto Rican Power Authority, had opted to hire Whitefish directly rather than use what's called a mutual aid agreement with other utilities. These are agreements that power companies or utilities have between each other. They were used in Florida and Texas to recover after the storms down there. And, you know, we had asked officials in Puerto Rico why they had reached out to Whitefish directly, or rather why this mutual aid process at minimum was bypassed. And, you know, its executive director and spokesman didn't return requests for comment seeking answers to that question. I think that's the big question, is why a normal route for doing this sort of aid was bypassed.
I mean, and it's a $300 million contract. Now, have they ever done a job of the size that they're tackling in Puerto Rico?
That was a question that we asked, and I think it's unclear. I think, you know, to their credit, they say that they are more particularly adept at handling mountainous areas, or maybe not so much mountainous, but rugged terrain. I mean, these are people who have to work out of very high heights out of helicopters to fix power lines. The real question here is why was this mutual aid agreement bypassed? Because it's not like some of these other power companies in Florida or elsewhere don't have that experience as well. I think what's interesting here too is the amount of money. I mean, this is by far the largest contract that this company has ever received. I mean, next to the $1.3 million contract they got just a few months ago. This is an island, mind you, a U.S. Commonwealth that is also, you know, under bankruptcy protection. So
yeah,
there are questions of finances and how best this $300 million is spent, which, you know, FEMA may reimburse some, if not all of that, by the time this is done.
So you have some amazing details in your story here, because Whitefish now told you that they have some 280 workers in Puerto Rico. And according to the contract, which you looked at. The cost for subcontractors, which make up the bulk of Whitefish's workforce, $462 per hour for a supervisor, $320 for a lineman. And Whitefish also charges nightly accommodation fees of $332 per worker and almost $80 per day for food. Now, that may or may not be in line with, you know, similar jobs for other hurricane-ravaged areas, but I'm curious, what do we know so far about whether they'll be able to complete the work? Because the Puerto Rico's governor said that 95% of the island's power would be back by Christmas. Is that what Whitefish is saying?
Well, when we had spoken to the CEO a few days ago, he had initially expressed some doubt that that would be the case. He, in fact, had said, you know, he didn't know where the governor was getting his information from, and really underscored, which I think is true here, just how much of a reconstruction effort this is going to be. I mean, as you'd mentioned earlier, you have transmission lines, you have power generating stations, you have most of the island that is without electricity. And, you know, this is not a trivial process. Some of these hourly rates that I think are in here, like you mentioned, a $330 for an hour for a site supervisor are high. You know, the company would turn around and say, well, look, this is extraordinarily difficult work, working, you know, very long hours with really no connection to the outside world, given, you know, some of the telecommunications are down as well, and just, you know, long, exhausting, laborious work. I think, you know, I think there's a sense that by Christmas that might be a little optimistic.
Jack Gillum with The Washington Post. Thanks so much. Danielle Allen's new book, Cuz, is about the American story of mass incarceration. It's also the deeply personal story of her own family. Her cousin Michael. In the 1990s, he went from being a regular 15-year-old to facing a potential life sentence in just one day. Now, Danielle and Michael's families were close, but she became a Harvard professor, and he was arrested for carjacking, serving more than a dozen years, and he died violently in 2009 at the age of 29. So how did that divergence happen? 'Cause, Danielle Allen writes, the war on drugs, mandatory minimum sentences, and a criminal justice system that locked up an entire generation and threw away the key. Well, I recently spoke with Danielle Allen, and we talked about how different her teenage years were from Michael's. She went to prom, had her first kiss, and Danielle said that in prison, Michael faced a very different set of milestones.
First long-term family separation. Yeah. So when he was 17, he was moved from the juvenile into the adult system, and he was moved to a prison at the Oregon border, which is crazy. I mean, it was so far away, his mother couldn't visit him. And, you know, other rituals are, you know, first administrative segregation, as it's called, which is a label for solitary confinement, first racial melee, first sodomization. When I was writing the book, one of the things that was very important to do was to try to juxtapose different teenage experiences, and in particular mine and my cousin's, and to show the things that are similar about them, the loneliness, the insecurity, the first experiments with intimacy and relationships and things like that, to show how, you know, this is a teenager going through all those experiences of an ordinary teenager, but in this cauldron of prison that is so violent and so full of brutality.
In the book, we hear Michael's voice.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
you include a lot of the writing that he did in prison.
He's very talented.
Extraordinarily talented.
Yeah. You know, he was astute. He was smart. He could express the most complex emotions and give voice to experiences that are unimaginable for those of us who've never been inside a prison. So let me just go ahead and read a little bit from his essay about Dante's Inferno. My hell is no longer demonstrating what I am capable of doing in order to survive. It has become what I can tolerate and withstand in order to live. I cannot help but to judge those around me. I am one of them, but we are far from the same. Like Dante, I am cursed with a spirit of discernment, which allows us to see the truth for what it is. There are most whom I despise who are truly sick beyond healing, and they should never leave this place. Then there are those who await to fulfill their destiny. I see in them a sincere and apologetic heart for their ill misdeeds. They are the ones who will change the world positively or positively change someone's world. Hell cannot hold the latter of the two opposites, but in time will only spit them back out into society to do what is right. The hell that I live in cannot hold Dante. Hell can test and try oneself, but it cannot hold Dante, and it will not hold me. In the inferno, the dead are trapped forever. Surely the biggest and most important difference in the inferno and my hell called prison is that I have a way out.
So right after that chapter where it's Michael's essay, there are two, I think, quite amazing chapters. And they're all about you, really. And these two chapters are two different takes on how you felt or what you saw when you visited Michael
right.
in prison.
Right, yes.
So tell
yes.
us about the first chapter.
Sure. So maybe I'll just read you a paragraph of it to give you a sort of a flavor, some of the flavor of it.
And this chapter is called Visiting 1.0.
Visiting 1.0, exactly. Yeah. As Michael, known to the system as K10033, wrote, inmates went by numbers, not names. And visiting days were allocated to sets of numbers. Half of the evens on one Saturday, half of the odds on Sunday, the other halves of each set the following week. At 7:30 a.m., the guards would let a parade of Kias and Hyundais, Chevys and Dodges into the parking lot, and then you would sign in at a lectern at the front of a canopied structure with wooden benches that looked something like a tent revival meeting. Hosts of mainly black and brown women, but white women too, and many children, and some men, flitted in the shadows under the canopy. We could take in up to $30 in quarters or singles in plastic baggies, and we always took the maximum. The point of this was to purchase treats for the inmates from the row of vending machines, dispensing, as it turned out, quite disgusting microwavable cheeseburgers and burritos, along with mystery meat plates. So that's, I had sort of written a chapter about visiting that tried to go into the just the detail of the place, the people who were there, the things you saw, the things you smelled, and so forth. But if you listen to that, I always, I'm talking about, you know, you see this, you see that, you do that. And my editor kept coming back and saying, you're not in this chapter, Danielle, you're not in this chapter. And I didn't know what he meant. I was like, but I'm describing everything I saw, you know, this detail, that detail, and so forth. And finally, I realized what he meant, which is that up in the book, in that up until that point, I had been using I. Uh-huh. I had been saying, I felt, I did X. And suddenly in this chapter, I switched to you. And that was like this huge light bulb going off that even at this point, you know, many drafts into working on the book, I had not been able to break through a certain kind of repression to say, I was in prison. And here's what it was like for me. So I went back and wrote that chapter.
And so you wrote it. You wrote it again.
I wrote it again. So then we have Visiting 2.0. So I can read a little bit of that. I will have to try again to describe what visiting Michael meant to me. The fact that I told the story as an academic already tells you everything you need to know. That wound of visiting Michael in prison goes so deep that somehow, even in writing this book, I have found it hard to own up to one simple fact. I went to prison. I was in prison. No, I don't mean that I have been arrested or convicted of a crime. I have avoided that because thus far in life, I have had that combination of goods that the ancient Greek philosopher Aristotle thought was necessary for a happy life. Resources, decent character, and luck. But no, I was not in prison as a convict, and this is thanks to my father, my mother, and my God. Yet even as someone who could come and go, I felt the prison's mark, its branding fork. I felt it in my soul, even though all I was there was a day's sojourner.
You okay?
Yeah, thanks. Yeah.
Forgive me for saying this, but that duality that we see in the first and second chapter there, I've even seen it here just
right
in our conversation.
I'm not surprised.
I mean, I can see that there are times when we're talking about sort of the policy implications of of criminal justice that you have a bold confidence. But when we get close to talking about really the impact that this has had on you and and Michael, it's hard.
Yeah, no, it's hard. I mean, you know, the whole point of being an academic is that you don't do this kind of thing. But so I'm grateful to Michael because one of the things I've learned from doing this is just how important it is. Sorry. even as an academic, to put head and heart together.
You and your family put so much effort into trying to rebuild his life. But his story is one where he could not get past the wounds and the consequences of those wounds that he suffered while in prison. And he got killed.
Yeah, no, that's right. Well, it's just, you know, at the time when he was thinking about whether to take this apartment, I could not understand his thinking, his choice. I could not see what, I had no idea what was going on. I could make no sense of it at all. All I knew is, you know, at the end of 24 hours, he had decided firmly that he wasn't going to take the apartment. And then it wasn't until four or five months later when he called and said he was ready to take an apartment. And I went to go look at it with him. And he said that he and his girlfriend, Bree, were going to move into the apartment. Bree was his girlfriend whom he'd met in prison. Mm-hmm. So a transgender woman. They'd been lovers in prison, and I did not know that they were still seeing each other. They had reconnected after he got out. And I suddenly understood that that was what his decision-making was about that day when he couldn't take that apartment. It was a choice right then between Bree's world and the world he had had for the last 11 years and the world of his family, which he'd had too, but over the telephone. And with that choice in front of him, he chose the love of his life.
What is the lesson from Michael's life?
You know, I've been trying to boil it down to just one lesson, and I just find it impossible to do. I think Michael himself took responsibility for his choices, and his Dante essay makes that very clear. He understood he'd made the wrong choices, and he understood himself to have been motivated by, in his words, greed and lust in the moment when he tried to steal the car. And he knew that, and he changed, and he had a view about what was wrong with his own decision-making. But at the same time that he accepted personal responsibility for his own choices, I think as a society, we also have to accept responsibility for the fact that we present young people with vastly disparate degrees of difficulty on the life courses in front of them. And yes, even in the most difficult circumstances, some people can master the degree of difficulty and overcome, but many people can't. And when society is leaving young people in poverty, leaving young people without access to good education, we have to recognize that we are creating the patterns, the degrees of difficulty that they're obliged to confront.
Danielle Allen is author of Cuz, The Life and Times of Michael A.
WeWork, the company that provides office space and services for small companies and individuals, has announced plans to move its headquarters into the iconic Lord & Taylor flagship building on New York's Fifth Avenue. WeWork, just 7 years old, announced the $850 million deal today. Ali Velshi is MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent and co-host of Velshi and Rule. Hi, Ali.
Hey, Robin. You know, I've followed this company since it started, and I have to say, maybe I'm just a little old. I thought to myself, that's kind of weird what this company's up to, but it's growing.
I'm thinking of Easter hats, which my grandmother used to get at Lord & Taylor. Those days are gone.
Yeah.
But WeWork is so young. Big move.
So this is about as opposite two industries as you can imagine, right? Lord & Taylor is suffering along with other retailers, and it's probably suffering a little bit more than they all are. But one thing American retailers have is space. WeWork is all about the millennial and how they work. They don't want to own anything. They don't need it personalized. They like shared space. They like being amongst other people. So it's an interesting space where WeWork and shared workspaces are growing in their demand for square footage. Retailers are shrinking in there, so they've made this deal to take over this space, and it's good for Lord & Taylor. It'll be a shrunken Lord & Taylor on Fifth Avenue, and they're hoping that all these cool, young, hip WeWork people will help their retail business. I don't know if it's the same audience, but we'll have to see about that.
Well, WeWork is also expanding into things like fitness classes with its new Rise by We.
Yep.
How's that working?
So there are a few things. You know, WeWork is the concept that you pay for the space that you need in and amongst other people. It's really ride sharing for working. And they've realized that people just like the lifestyle. They like everything about it. So they've got this Rise where you join and it's got wellness classes and yoga and meditation and kickboxing and things like that. They just opened in October this month, but they're planning on expanding. They have We Live apartments, same idea. You can live month to month in shared spaces. So it's a company. Again, I remember when it started thinking, huh, that's kind of neat. Maybe I'm just not young enough to get it. But this, they have tapped into something. It's a remarkably fast-growing company that's based on sharing your stuff.
Well, is it a bubble? Is it overvalued? We've seen headlines, CEO Adam Neumann bragging about selling $100 million worth of WeWork shares. That's, not a good sign.
There's the reality that this company is really growing, and then there's the valuation. But again, you know, at some point when you look at the valuations of Uber and, you know, companies like this, you wonder what relationship that has to reality. They got WeWork got a funding investment that has sent its valuation up to $20 billion.
What?
A Japanese fund has invested in it. It's got, just to tell you what it's like, it's got 200 locations in 52 cities. It's got about 150,000 members. It's a neat company, but I'm not sure how it gets to $20 billion, but it is the fourth most valuable U.S. startup after Uber, Airbnb, and SpaceX. So it gives you some sense of where the money is going these days. It's not going to traditional retailers like Lord & Taylor, for instance.
Well, yeah. Well, the Wall Street Journal, though, called it a $20 billion startup fueled by Silicon Valley pixie dust.
Mm-hmm. So that's what works these days, apparently.
This could be maybe a sock puppet. We don't know.
Pop into a WeWork space, everybody who's listening to this, just to understand how the world is going.
MSNBC's Ali Velshi, also co-host of Velshi & Rule. Thank you.
Bye, Rob.
A majority of Americans across the board say they face discrimination. No surprise that minorities say that, but a majority of whites in the U.S. also believe whites face discrimination. That finding is in a new poll from NPR, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, and the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. NPR's Don Gagne has more.
First, some numbers you might expect. 9 out of 10 African Americans say discrimination against them exists. 8 in 10 Latinos say the same. For Asian Americans, it's 6 in 10. But what about white Americans? Well, more than half, 55% of those we surveyed, say whites, too, face discrimination. We heard answers like this.
It's been going on for decades, and it's getting worse for whites now.
That's 68-year-old Tim Hirschman in Ohio. It's getting worse for whites, he says. He was one of the survey respondents who agreed to answer some follow-up questions. Hirschman is blunt when offering his personal opinion of government programs. In his view, they give out handouts to blacks and ignore the needs of whites.
Look at the government housing that the government puts out there in Akron and Cleveland and all your cities. It's obvious that they're getting more help than what whites do.
He represents one category of respondents to our survey, whites who say whites face discrimination and say they felt it, either in seeking a job or a raise or promotion or on a college application. 50-year-old Tim Music, a heavy equipment operator who lives outside Washington, D.C., falls into a different category. He says he has not faced discrimination personally, but he thinks it does exist against whites. He spoke during his lunch break at the construction site.
Pretty much because you're white, you're automatically thrown into that group as being a bigot and a racist, and that somehow you perceive yourself as being more superior to everybody else, which is ridiculous. I'm just a man that happened to have been born white.
Music has the stocky build of an NFL lineman and a shaved head under his hard hat. He stresses he's not comparing what happens to whites to the African-American experience.
I don't know what it feels like to be a black man walking around in the streets, but I do know what it feels like to be pegged because of how you look and what people perceive just on sight.
Now for the third category white Americans fall into in our survey, those who scoff at the notion that whites face racial discrimination.
I don't see how we can be discriminated against when we have all the power.
Retired community college teacher Betty Holton in Maryland sums up that point of view.
Look at Congress, look at Senate, look at government on every level. Look at the leadership in corporations, look anywhere. So the notion that whites are discriminated against just seems incredible to me.
David Cohen, a political scientist at the University of Akron, says the NPR poll and its finding that a solid majority of whites say whites are victims of discrimination fits into one of the big narratives of the last campaign.
I think this does reinforce a lot of the resentment that you saw in the 2016 election, and especially among white working class voters, lacking a college degree.
But he also adds that for all the talk of Donald Trump's message speaking directly to whites in the working class, white voters supported him in only about the same numbers as they did Mitt Romney 4 years earlier, 58% for Trump, 59% for Romney. And though it's possible that Trump's message to disaffected whites did make a difference in decisive battleground states of Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania, Cohen says the question remains, did Trump create or significantly boost white resentment, at least in those key states, or did he simply ride a long existing trend?
So I'm not sure that he necessarily created this angst out there with white voters, but I certainly think that he tapped into it and understood how to take advantage of it, at least from a public relations perspective.
And it's something Trump, as president, has only continued to tap into. Don Gagne, NPR News.
Well, now to that videotape from members of the Short Pump Middle School football team in Glen Allen, Virginia. It went viral. It's now hard to find because, and a warning, what it shows is so disturbing the whole football season has been canceled. For instance, white football players simulate the rape of black players while saying they're going to blank the black out of these black children from Uganda. And that's just part of the tape. Mickey Ogburn is a member of the Henrico County School Board representing the Three Chopped District and the Short Pump Middle School. Mickey, what'd you think when you first saw this video?
Well, it was a little over a week ago, and as most people who have seen it, I was appalled. There are lots of adjectives that you can use, shocked, appalled, we're disheartened, we're disappointed, baffled, everything. It runs the gamut.
Well, parents were shocked as well. And
yes.
Let's just say the video was apparently made by the players last week in the locker room. It was put on Snapchat, and then a portion was put on local news. And a lot of parents are wondering, you know, first of all, why didn't they find out sooner about this? How did it get on a local news station first? And where were the adults in the room? Kids in locker rooms are supposed to be supervised.
Right. Well, it was actually taken on Friday, a week and a half ago, and it was not posted until the weekend. We were made aware of it on Monday of last week. I think that's the 19th, something like that. And two students at another middle school nearby saw it and did what we ask children to do, which is they went and told an administrator. And that's actually how we found out, was students reported it. We then immediately went into finding out who was involved and everything that, you know, everybody has asked.
What are some of the answers? I mean, some of the parents are saying, wait a second, because as we said, the games have been canceled, but kids are still required to go to practice because you're going to start some sensitivity training. But some parents are saying, why punish the whole team? How many members of the team actually participated in the video?
Well, that number we're still working on because obviously you have to get children to admit that they were there. We have a program in Henrico County, as I think many schools do. It's called Silence Hurts. We encourage children, just like the first kids who saw this video, to go to a trusted adult and say, I saw something that bothers me that I know is wrong. And so when we know that other players on the team could have been aware that this was going on and they didn't speak up, at that point we're like, okay, the members of this team all need to come together in a positive way to learn from this experience. If you didn't report it, you need to report. It's your ethical and moral duty to report.
Well, so you're going to have some training during their practices.
Absolutely.
On accountability, yes. Reporting responsibilities, yes. Ethics. But what about the kids who actually, for instance, did the simulated attacks? What do we know if the young black players were agreeing to be treated this way?
Well, since this involves children, I am not really at liberty to tell anything about the children mm-hmm. in the video, other than we have a very strict code of conduct. The code of conduct was immediately and severely implemented for those students who are the perpetrators of it. The victims, we are providing counseling. We're providing support in every way that we can to make sure that they're getting the help that they need.
Well, you're calling them victims, which tells us something there. Look, as you well know, Lorraine Wright represents the I Vote For Me Human mm-hmm. Rights Group. They advocate for equality in education. She says she's filing a federal complaint with the Office for Civil Rights. I'm sure you're also hearing from people saying this was stupid, but these are kids, mm-hmm. and the best thing to do is to keep them in the school environment and, you know, help them learn from it.
Well, we do want the children to learn from it, because obviously we can't undo what was done, but we can make sure as much as is possible that this kind of incident doesn't happen again, that we want to teach our kids that we need to treat each other equitably and fairly with tolerance of all races, creeds, and colors. Of course, that's what we expect of our students.
That's Mickey Ogburn, a member of the Henrico County School District there in Virginia. The Short Pump Middle School is in that district, and their football team is in a world of hurt because of a video that's gone viral. Mickey, thank you so much for talking to us about it.
You're welcome. Best
dealing with this.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
And you're listening to Here and Now.
It's been 2 months since Hurricane Harvey hit Texas, but Alma Roberts still hasn't been able to return to her flood-ravaged home in Houston. Now, she's got flood insurance, and she's made a claim, but getting the money from that claim is taking a lot longer than she expected, and Alma's been through this twice before. In the meantime, she and her family are whittling down their savings in order to stay in a rental. And she joins us now. And Alma, first of all, we are so sorry about what you've been going through and are still going through, because we understand you haven't received any payments yet from your insurance company or from FEMA, if I've got that right. So what exactly have your interactions with them been like so far?
I'm scared to be completely honest, but because I haven't heard back, I'm like, I hope, you know, that this is just hopefully educational for some people, but it's been really disappointing. About 3 weeks ago, I called, and I was on hold for 2 hours and 47 minutes, holding just to get a little bit more information as far as when can we expect, you know, to see a check, or, you know, what were the next steps, just to move forward with the process. It just seems a lot slower this time. You know, we were giving them a lot of slack. We knew that initially they came to Houston, but then they had to travel to Florida. So I guess with that in the back of my mind, I've been trying to be more patient. But like I said, just kind of dwindling our funds, paying for rent. Initially, we had to pay for moving expenses. We did remediation to our house ourselves in order to save a little bit of money. Again, lesson learned from the previous floods, where we paid a lot of money for that. So we've done a lot more ourselves, just a little bit more educated on the process. But it's a lot slower this time for some reason. So we haven't heard back as of today.
And just so I'm clear, is this from your insurance company you're talking about, or from FEMA?
So it is a little confusing. The way I understand is we have insurance. It's through a big provider, but everything goes through FEMA, which is kind of like the bank. So even though we're insured, we still have to correspond with FEMA. We had two different people show up at the house. One was an insurance inspector or adjuster, and then we had someone from FEMA also come a couple weeks afterwards. And apparently both of those had to be done in order for us to move forward. It's probably been over a month since we had the FEMA person at the house do an inspection. So we're still waiting. You know, he said it was going to take a couple weeks for him to get the report. And based on that conversation, I had even asked for an advance, you know, just to help us get moving forward, and haven't heard back.
I see. Okay, so when you were on hold for that 2 hours and 47 mm-hmm. minutes, that was with FEMA?
Yes.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. And so how have you been getting by in the interim? I mean, you're talking about spending down your savings, which no one really wants to have to do. And I understand that. Did you or some of your friends help you set up a GoFundMe?
Yeah, I have a friend from New Jersey set up a GoFundMe. She was trying to send pizza. She was trying to get creative. And she said, look, I want to help. And she's like, you know, would it be okay? And I said, you know what? I'm not too proud after this third flood. And we borrowed quite a bit of money 2 years ago to make the house look right. You know, we've invested, like I said, so much of our own money. And I said, you know what? I can't do this alone. And the GoFundMe, it's a little bit of money, but it's helped us cover at least 2 months of rent. So people do want to help, and every little bit, you know, it adds up. So I think I was going to share with you, I went to a conference last week. It had nothing to do with the flood. But one of the topics was about resilience and how just being grateful for the things you do have, it helps, you know. And there are people that, you know, are going through worse. So I guess that's the part that's helped me out.
Yeah.
Just to move forward, you know.
Yeah, I get it. People feel grateful for every little bit of help they receive. But, you know, it's that check from your insurers and from FEMA, which is really going to help you get your whole family's lives on track, right? And but you keep driving by the house every day checking the mail, and the check isn't there yet.
That is correct. And that's the other thing, too. It's like, while I'm over here trying my hardest to be positive, it's like every day that I'm out of the house, every month, literally, it costs us more money. You know what I mean? And we do want to get back into the house. I'm not a desperation mode, but pretty soon, you know, that's how I feel. And that's the part that's humbling, but it's almost like an embarrassment. You know, it's like, I'm literally, you know, out of the house. I'm destitute. But again, it's like, hey, look, our friends are trying to help us out. I mean, friends have offered us their place. It's just a big family, so that's not really an option for us, you know?
Yeah. Well, Alma Roberts of Houston, thank you so much for speaking with us, and I really hope things get back on track as soon as they possibly can for you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Now, we did reach out to FEMA to get more details about Alma's claim, and FEMA spokesman Leo Skinner said the agency cannot talk about individual cases, but he did provide us with this information. He says it can take up to 45 days on average for a FEMA inspector to get to a home after an owner files a claim. Then it should take 7 to 10 days to process that claim. But Skinner added that this comes at a time when FEMA is also working to assist hurricane victims in Florida and Puerto Rico, as well as those impacted by wildfires in California. Skinner says so far, FEMA has distributed more than $1.2 billion in Texas. Now, as for the fact that Alma Roberts was on hold for almost 3 hours when she tried to call FEMA, Skinner says wait times vary, and he pointed out that there are more than 40 disaster recovery centers in Texas, and suggests that residents who have questions about their claims can talk to a FEMA representative at one of those centers face-to-face to find out more about their status. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.